Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
I'm Mel Barrett.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
And welcome to Something's Off, a true crime podcast where we just talk about things that make our heads spin. Yes. And we have a lot to get to today.
Great log line, by the way. That's going to be our log line from now on.
Things that make your head spin. We haven't seen each other in a while. We did a dark episode last week. We released the Turtle Boy interview that you and I did back in, I think it was July. It was right after the trial. And just as an explanation, because I kind of made that decision. I asked you, obviously, if it was okay. But one of the reasons why I wanted to do it was because there's just so much about how awful he is right now out there. And I wanted to show that even though we disagree on a lot of things, he's a normal human being who is very honest about his tactics and what he does and who he is. And so I thought it was really important to show that. We got a little
normal?
Bit of pushback.
I don't know, normal? Yeah.
I mean, I hate that word normal because, you know, people are like, oh, you know, normal is like heterosexual couples with 2.5 kids and a dog.
Yeah, there's a lot going on with him and the internet right now and his ex-girlfriend, Meredith O'Neill, and the additional drama that has stirred up began with this woman, I believe her name is Chelsea, who basically had said to him at some point, like, it hurts my feelings. I heard her say this on his live. Like, I am hurt that you keep characterizing this as Meredith did nothing wrong. Although I honestly, you know, I'll just be honest with you. Like, I knew about some of this before it all came out. Like, I knew about some of the circumstances around the Karen Reed recording. I knew about some of the interpersonal stuff because I was told it. And I was also, I'm a discreet person, so I would never be like, you're never going to believe what I was told. Right. Like, it's just not something I would do. So I'm just going to say I was not super surprised to see all of this kind of blow up. Can we talk about this briefly right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to let the audience know, you know, we haven't seen each other in a bit and we put that dark episode out and I wanted to give a reason behind it because we got some pushback. So Go.
We're also going to be talking today a little bit about Brian Walsh, and we're going to be talking about an update in the Kelsey Fitzsimmons case. So folks know it's not going to be all gossip all the time. I actually want to keep this fairly brief. I have been keeping up with what's been going on. There is a universe. Aiden may not agree with this. Others may not agree with this. There is a universe in which multiple people's point of view could be understood or even be okay. Like, I'm thinking of Boston Brandy, for instance. This is woman Brandy, who is on Twitter, who has been a huge supporter of Karen Reed's and Aiden Carney's and has been pushing back on some of the online show behavior that she finds objectionable that Aiden's doing. She's like, focus, keep your eyes on the prize. Yeah. And they had a dust up online. And then she said, she went on a show and they talked about it, which is like, that is the fucking way to do stuff, is to actually talk. And also to talk in a way that's like a good faith exercise, right? It has continued to devolve. I'll just say I tweeted this, but it's true. If you were really involved in this world and this was like your main internet life, like these people seems to be their main internet life, you would think that every person has had a police report written about them, a restraining order filed against them, and some embarrassing legal shit in their background. And I just want to make
it
clear. That is actually not every person's experience. That is like a relatively, not rare, but relatively rare experience among true crime fans, among people like me who do journalism and commentary. Like, it's not a world that I am used to and familiar with, this like long protracted history of stalking exes, like all this stuff, and other things, not just that, like custody stuff, all this stuff. So I just want to say that the fact that that's kind of being normalized as weaponry online is disturbing. But there are patterns in all these people's lives that sort of point to the fact that nobody came into this situation with a fully pure heart and clean hands. Now, I believe the difference, I think, between Aiden Carney and everybody else is he puts his unclean hands and impure heart on display for everybody all the time, like without shame. Like, he's just like, I'm about vengeance. I fucking hate this person. I fucking hate this person. This happened to me. I like looking at my own sex videos to masturbate. Like, I'm disgusting. Like, he's like Joey in that episode where of Friends where Joey finds out that Monica and Chandler are sleeping together and he's keeping it secret. And other people keep finding evidence of them sleeping together. And he's like, I'm Joey. I'm disgusting. I like to film myself having sex. Like, that's what I'm like. I don't really love Friends, but that is my favorite episode because I'm a Joey fan. He reminds, he's like that. He is vengeful. He is, he can be mean. He can be deeply funny.
He's a teenage boy.
He's, he has the heart of a teenage boy. He has the urges of a teenage boy, but he has the whip smart intelligence of a grown ass man. And he has the ability to cut like a grown ass man. And he uses that. And it slices both ways. It can be deeply offensive. It can also be incredibly productive. It can be entertaining. He said something very apt on his show, was live, one of his live streams last week, which was he said that the Turtle Boy brand has warmth in it. Now, he was talking about Meredith and how he says that she wants to be like Turtle Boy. She's like, she wanted to be Mrs. Turtle Boy, he says. She was doing all this research, putting out all these, like, all this documentation. He's like, you know, she has this other job and she also thought she could do what I do. He's like, but nobody can do what I do because my brand has a humor and warmth to it that softens somewhat all of the shit that I do. He didn't say exactly that way, but that's kind of what he meant. And he's not wrong.
No, I'd agree with that.
He's not wrong. Like, I find him, even when he's saying stuff that I'm like, that's fucking bananas, I find it, I understand the entertainment value of it. Like, he's good at his job, right? And you can look at his life and say, like, he needs to touch grass more. He needs to be online less. Like, maybe he should have more, like, IRL friends or whatever. But that's his, these are all his choices, right? And this is what he does. It's monetized very well. He's very successful right now. And this is not an excuse. It's all just true. Now, I'm watching this whole thing unfold. And I am so desperate. Now, I still follow Meredith. She hasn't blocked me at this point. Maybe she will after this broadcast. I don't know. But I've been trying to sort of like, at the beginning, sort of understand. I'm like, these are two exes. They're both hurt in their own ways. He initially said, I'm not going to talk about my ex relationships. I don't do that on the show unless I have to, or unless I don't think anyone has to do anything, just to be clear. And she was relatively quiet about her own thing. Now, what has emerged since then is behavior between the two of them and between other people that I think anyone could classify as like out of bounds, but they're both participating in it. So Turtle Boy is doing what Turtle Boy does, and Meredith is fully participating in it. And and you can say, people have said to me, she has no choice. She's, I'm like, are you kidding me? Everybody
has
a choice. And she started engaging immediately with Chelsea and with all these inbound people who were like accusing her of things, and whether or not she did these things or not, and some of them she did do. I don't know about all of them, but some of them she did do. She certainly did have an incredibly problematic incident with an ex-boyfriend, some more than one incident that led to, I think, a well-deserved protective order, restraining order. That happened 8 years ago. And she will say again and again and again, and she said this about incidents with Aiden, too, when she talks about the tapes of their fights that she made. She says, yes, this happened. It was a long time ago. I was really upset. That's not me. I've changed since then, whatever. But I'm like, how much of this pattern do you need to have in your life where you can continue to say, that's not who I am. That's not me. I regret it. Because it's still like that kind of nuttiness about relationship stuff is still occurring, and it was recurring while they were together, which is the reason why there is fodder to discuss anything now. Now, again, this is not, I'm not saying all Meredith's fault. No, they're both engaging.
Acting unhinged. They're not keeping anything private. They're displaying everything about their chaos on the internet.
And the difference between the two people is that this is Aidan Carney and always has been. And I would expect nothing different. If I did something that pissed him off and he talked about it on his show, I would be 0% surprised.
Right.
I wouldn't say I deserved it. I wouldn't say whatever, but I'd be 0% surprised. And I would not engage. When people started coming at me on Twitter, I would just mute. When people started talking about whatever, I don't feel the need, and I don't think anybody should feel the need to be forced to defend themselves. No one is forcing you to do anything. You're not under arrest. You're not being, Twitter is not real life. I know that it is very much real life for a subset of people. It is not real life. It is a propaganda machine. It is a messaging machine. It is a, just like any social media platform, it is a mechanism to put a version of yourself into the world that is not fully who you are and does not fully represent your life, except maybe in the case of Kate Peter, because she does it 24 hours a day. but it is not that. And when I see people devolving into a person who is ostensibly working during the day, but also doing this all day, engaging with people, being fraught, really hurting themselves. Like, you can manifest pain by projecting pain. And I hate the word manifest, but you can. Just like you can stop smoking by manifesting it if you are a certain kind of person, right? But like almost everybody, if they talk about being in a grievance long enough, I've done this myself with work situations or whatever, you will be more aggrieved for longer because you're engaging with the pain, right? And she can do whatever she wants to do. All these people can do whatever they want to do. I don't know any of them. I'm just seeing it all. And I see there is definitely a world in which Boston Brandy, that's her Twitter handle, by the way, I don't know if that's her name, could say, listen, I support you. I've bought tickets to your shows. I like you. I don't like that you're doing this. And I can still think that Boston Brandy is like a decent person because she's just finding her like measure here, right? There's a world in which Mike Crawford can be like, I watched the video he just put out. You're a fucking baby, Aidan. You have no life. You tried to set me up. You did this, and is calling him out for all the things that he says that Aidan. And Aidan can just be doing what he does. And Mike Crawford in his own world can be a good person. Like, there's all of that is possible, and all of that is true. What is wrong here is the strong desire to engage. And yeah. I know, and I'm not saying people should avoid confronting or accusing Aidan Carney of bad shit if they don't want to, you know, if they don't want him to talk about them, because he will talk about you. But it's the choice to engage further that is causing so much havoc on the internet. And it's like, you don't have to respond. You don't have to, quote, show receipts. You don't have to collect receipts of any interaction you have in your life. The idea that, like, you would record somebody in an argument where you sound as unhinged as the other person sounds. There was one phone call, for instance, that really disturbed me, okay? This was this one phone call that Meredith recorded where Aidan is basically telling her, and granted, I'm not saying this was every true intentions, but this is what I heard, which is him saying, I need you to apologize to me for sharing the recording of Karen Reed with other people. And she's like, I just shared it with people I thought I could trust. And he's like, whatever. It's like, I'm just seeing if you do you feel bad about this, essentially is his thing. And I'm sure there was more context to it. And I'm not saying that that was also okay. I don't know. But she kept saying on and on and on, I just want you to leave me alone. I don't want to talk to you anymore. Leave me alone. Don't talk. You know how to get someone to stop talking to you? You hang up the fucking phone.
Yes. Yes.
You don't continue the recorded argument by performatively telling someone to leave you alone and that you don't want to talk anymore.
Yes.
You hang up the fucking phone. So yes. I think the idea there was it's going to give a certain perception of I am being abused, attacked. All I want is to be left alone. I'm a normal emotional person, blah, 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 blah. See, I'm telling him to leave me alone and he won't. If you want to be left alone, you hang up the fucking phone. If you don't want to be attacked on the internet, you don't You don't go back on the internet and continue to engage. You just stop. A tweet about your fucking cats. Like, tweet about something else. Like, don't engage with this world anymore. If you don't want to be a part of this world anymore, then don't engage with it. And if you're engaging with it, it means you do want to be a part of this world.
Yeah.
So just own it.
All,
own it.
It all goes back to a lot of what we do nowadays. And I'm saying we collectively. It's for show. It's for entertainment. It's for clicks. It's for monetization. And it goes
to get
back
people
to,
on your team. It's for popularity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I talked about this a few episodes ago, this fiction depersonalization syndrome. Did I talk to you about that?
I think so. Go ahead and tell me.
It's a syndrome that was discovered, I don't know how many years ago. I used it. It's sort of the basis of the first novel that I wrote. And basically, it comes from this world of reality television, you know, starting with like cops going up to the real world, where we are living our days as if a camera is on us at all times and we have to act for it. So fiction depersonalization syndrome. We are disconnecting from reality in order to create. And we do it even when we're alone. Like if I'm sitting in this room right now and it's just me and Ruby, and I am imagining cameras, you know, in the corners of the room, capturing my every movement as if I was on the real world. And I have to create a persona and I have to be a certain way. And I'm thinking about it right now. And I'm like, am I doing it right now? Because we all do it to some extent.
There's
you know?
Proof. But this is one small piece of proof of that is stylish loungewear. Like we were young, you put on the fucking ugliest pair of sweatpants and your ugliest t-shirt to hang out around the house because no one was going to see you. Now there's this need to put on cute pajamas, stylish loungewear, cute yoga pants, whatever, because it's like someone might see. No.
Someone might see.
No.
And these like imaginary cameras. But the thing is, the cameras are no longer imaginary. They are everywhere. We're holding them in our pockets. They are on street corners. They're everywhere. Like, I can't imagine how anyone gets away with a crime anymore just because everything is recorded. We'll get to that in the Brian Walsh case. But I think that we're all sort of suffering from this. And then you add social media to it and you add the monetization of social media to it. And now it's not – now that phone call between Meredith and Turtle Boy is about her – creating her drama, creating this act, creating a scenario and a story that she needs the audience to understand so that she gets more clicks, so that she gets monetized. I'm not, that's my opinion. I don't want her to like come
out. I don't
know
if she's being monetized or no. I don't know if she's pursuing that, but I think that the clicks, the attention, the being on my side, the feeling vindicated by a stranger telling you you're right.
Yes. I mean, it can be, you can, cops do it. They do it with their body cameras when they're saying, this is a very simple example, when someone is lying on the ground and they're cuffing them and that person is not resisting and they're saying, stop resisting. That's for the cameras. That's for the court hearing. You know, we are living in this era where, like I said, everything is recorded and we have these devices that will tell our story. But oftentimes we're creating that story in the moment, or we've created a persona to go along with that story. Right. And when I see all these people in this chaos, A, I think our emotional intelligence is in the toilet. And B, I think it's all fake. You know, I mean, it's not all fake. I don't want to say that. I said this to you the other day about Aiden. I do think that he has real human emotions and feelings, and he is not afraid to talk about them, which is one of the things I respect about him. He got on and he told that whole story about being in jail and how that felt. And when someone came along and showed him mercy and kindness and love, he grasped onto that. That is a true, honest human experience. However, when you meet that person in real life and they turn out to be crazy or they turn out to be unhinged and you are as well, and it's an unhealthy relationship, you've got to, instead of fostering that relationship, you've got to like start to see that. And I don't think that we start to see that until we get a little bit older.
Right.
And to me, like I said, Aiden to me feels like a 17-year-old boy whose like hormones are raging.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, again, an adult man with adult man power. So I think you're right. I think both things can be true.
White man.
I just want to say one thing. I don't want to be like piled on for being
pro Aiden.
Well, it's not that. I mean, I like him. I like a lot of these people. I am very, very concerned about anyone who pursues a relationship with an incarcerated person. Because this is a long term. This is not because of the situation. Like, there are documented, studied, data driven analyses on this. There is a power dynamic that is inherent when somebody is incarcerated that you have over them when you are free, even if they have a huge platform, even if they are, tough, even if they are then there for murder or whatever, you have more power, right? And I think that most people don't go into those relationships thinking, I want power over this person. They go into it altruistically, thinking you can love somebody who's behind bars or whatever. But it can, not always, but it can create an incredibly toxic dynamic where you are so dependent. The person, incarcerated person, becomes so dependent on the person who started the relationship with them. And if those dynamics carry out into the real world, it can become, clearly it can become toxic, or it can become broken, or it can turn into a whole other thing. You see this a lot with people who get married in prison. You see this a lot with, there are people, not just women, but also men, who actively pursue relationships with people in prison because they're not going anywhere.
Right.
They're, you know what I mean? This is not what I'm saying happened, but I'm saying that dynamic... first of all, think about the kind of person who would want to potentially, who could see potential there.
When I heard those first messages that Meredith sent to Aiden, I didn't see somebody who was looking for a romantic relationship. I saw somebody who was looking for status and power and was using romantic language to get that. Hmm. And Aiden, I mean, obviously, he was in such a vulnerable place. He obviously didn't see that. There had to be something in the back of his mind going, though, all these people just want to get to me for the attention or the status or whatever it might be. But I think that he is such a lonely person that he clings on to these women who, shower praise and are like, I'm your biggest supporter and I'll be there for you. And I want to be Mrs. Turtle Boy and I want to do this with you.
Yeah.
Love bombing. So I just don't see, I see a lot of manipulation. And I think that Aiden either doesn't want to have his hackles up about manipulation that's incoming, or he just isn't seeing it because he's so desperate for love. Right. Honestly. But I think we need to move on from this, though.
Can I say briefly, I hate being one of these women who's like, it's the woman's fault. I do. It is completely possible to live a normal life, have a job and whatever, and be fucking terrible at relationships.
Sure.
It is completely possible. I think that, I think Aiden knows he's terrible at relationships. He just said, I'm terrible at being a boyfriend. I'm terrible at relationships. That's why I got divorced, blah, 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 blah. I'm sure he's going to be in another relationship. Like, don't fucking let him.
He probably already
is. He's a serial relationship haver. But the ex-boyfriend stuff disturbed me. It was very disturbing.
Yeah.
And the performative letter that she wrote to the boss and all this stuff, I'm not going to get super into it. It's disturbing. It's upsetting. You can also blame Aiden for knowing about it and getting into the relationship anyway, as she says. But let's just say stop engaging.
There's a pattern.
But stop engaging. Live a life that is healthy and normal and emotionally grounded and stop being like, and now I'm talking to Karen Reed, because that is exact. If you are, I don't give a shit if you're talking to Karen Reed, but performatively telling the world that you're talking to Karen Reed.
It's status.
It's gross. It's just, I mean, it is what it is. It's trying to be weaponized against somebody you used to love who hurt you. And I wouldn't do it. If they choose to do it, that's great. But if you really want to be left alone, you fucking hang up the phone and stop tweeting back. We can leave it there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then
you really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Just to transition, we did not say thank you to our tippers yet, but I want to say
speaking
thank
of
you.
Monetization of pain.
Well, this isn't pain. This is fun. And this is like, you know, I mean, it is entertainment, but we really care deeply about the psychology of these people and these cases that we're covering. And there's a lot of work that goes into it. So I just want to say thank you to the tippers. I really appreciate you. We also got a few new members last night during my live.
Oh, you went live. So exciting.
I went live last night. I went live without you. I know. I missed you. And I think it will be much better when you're there because it's so much easier to engage with somebody else who, you know, is a friend and who's talking to you as opposed to staring at the camera. And, you know, I'm a talker, obviously. Like, I can go on for hours. But it was like I was filling the space a little bit. There was a lot to talk about. I was talking about the Brian Walsh trial. But anyway, we are going to do more lives. And I think it will be really good to do that with you. And again, I just really appreciate all the people that engage. We had like 125 people last night. I thought that was a pretty good number.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that for monetization. I'm saying it's so exciting to me to be able to sit and talk about these cases, which is what I do all day. And I love it. And I got to do it last night with a live audience, and I'm excited for you to join me on that. So thank you to everyone who tipped.
I look forward to it. Let's do it sometime the next couple weeks. Yeah, let's do
absolutely. Is there anything else going on with, you know, Karen Reed adjacent stuff? Oh, I feel like there is.
There is. There's so much stuff. The lawsuit is progressing.
It's in federal court.
The Alberts have lawyered up. It's actually unclear. I've seen people say it's definitely in federal court, and I've seen people say it has to be like approved. I'm just going to assume it's going to be in federal court at this point, because that's what a lot of the reporting says. But Proctor finally got a lawyer. Yeah. So there's just a lot of interesting stuff going on. There are motions for all of Proctor's communications by Reed's team. Right. We are definitely in the pre-game phase. And there's nothing like, you know, everything that comes out feels like a revelation in the moment, but it's definitely really pre-game. We'll have more to talk about probably after the holidays, when people are actually more engaged in the courts and in that space, actually working and producing documentation. So, it's moving forward. So there's hearings coming up. We'll talk about those when they happen. I don't want to delve too much. I am very, very, very closely watching Matt Marbury v. Mads Twitter stuff.
I just want those sidebars.
She's doing a great job of dripping it. And so we'll talk about that stuff next time.
And the only thing that was interesting to me about the Karen Reed stuff, and this came up from one of Turtle Boy's lives, actually, they've only raised like $4,000 or $5,000 for Karen's legal defense.
Yeah, it's really controversial that she has this. Yeah.
And the McCabes have raised like $50,000.
I think more than that at this point, but they they've raised, but their campaign is so weird. It's so weird. They bought a huge billboard, which is very expensive and probably eating a lot of the money that they have actually raised. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say that, like, it's a PR. It appears to be more of a PR campaign than a fundraising campaign. Getting the message out there that we are worthy of donating to is just as powerful for a PR reason as it is for a monetization reason. And doing things like renting billboards shows me that. And, you know, I don't give a shit who people give their money to. If they want to give money to them, no problem. When I've never given money to a legal fund. I never would, unless it was maybe somebody in my family. I just think that that's you can't talk about a case if you've helped pay for the case, in my opinion.
Agreed.
So I haven't. I wouldn't. It's interesting that there's all this legal fund talk. People, you know, Meredith has accused Turtle Boy of you know, raising funds when he doesn't need them. People are accusing the McAlberts of raising funds when they don't need them because they have plenty of means or whatever. You know, nobody has enough means. I mean, people do. Few people have enough means to actually pay like $1 million in legal fees. But like, there's, you know, they're not a 501c3. They're not a nonprofit. You're not, your contribution is not tax deductible. You're just giving them a gift of your cash. If you want to do that, fine with me, even though I think you're supporting the wrong thing, but that's fine with me. I don't care. If you want to give to Aiden, I don't care. If you want to donate to Karen, I don't care. Karen is in the best position to monetize her life of all of these people.
I think raising money
for this fund is not a great look. I mean, she can do what she wants. It's fine. If people want to support her, that's great. Maybe they're just thinking, like, let's not leave anything on the table. Fine. But
Aiden's right. If she just did one interview.
Well, I don't agree with that. I don't think that doing the one interview thing is it. That's not it. That's not a long-term successful monetization plan. The long-term successful monetization plan is IP stuff. It's all that stuff. And she's in a great position to do it. She's doing it with Alan Jackson. He is actually in the deals with her. So it actually does not benefit him when they do things like raise money, because it can cast a light, like, if they need this, like, he must be charging. He's not charging her. They should be reveling in the success. That's not what they should be doing. They should be thinking about the long term. Is it worth getting 10 grand now and having people not and see you differently when your IP thing comes out? Or is it worth letting that go, giving up the ghost there, donating some money to a Chelsea Fitzsimmons fund or whatever from your fund, and just continuing your current strategy of letting your IP be your ultimate reward? Because that's what's happening. So,
yeah. Speaking of Kelsey Fitzsimmons, do you want to – there's been some really interesting – there's
– Tell me. Man,
this case is so interesting to me. It's getting more – interesting as we go. So basically, the last thing we talked about was this judge who just flippantly, like, revoked her bail in the moment and sent her to jail in that moment. And I was shocked by it. I think everybody that was watching was shocked by it, because I felt like the Kelsey's defense had made a really good argument about an alternate alcohol testing solution, and it was completely disregarded, and she went to jail. She's still in jail. So what's happened since then is her team appealed to what I understand to be a single justice. And then the Commonwealth responded to that appeal. It was denied. And then Bedereau filed an appeal with the full SJC, and it was denied. And the Commonwealth replied to that appeal. And now Bedereau has replied to the Commonwealth, and that was, he did it yesterday. So this is sort of brand new news. I want to go through really briefly some of the arguments that this was so well written, this motion. So basically what we're doing is we're waiting to see if there's going to be oral arguments or any kind of ruling from the bench. I'm going to quote from the motion that Bedereau wrote. The Commonwealth submission to the full bench dramatically expands its position far beyond the limited scope asserted in the trial court hearing under appeal, and raises new issues that were neither presented nor litigated by them below. The Commonwealth is changing its position, which they're not allowed to do. So basically, from the hearing they had about the alternate alcohol testing, and then she went to jail, the Commonwealth was on the same side as the defense. They didn't care. Mm-hmm. They were like, as long as the alcohol testing happens, we don't care.
Right.
Now they've written two separate responses that have come up with all these new arguments that they never raised. So A, can't do that. And so Bedereau is responding to that. And it's so good. It's so concise. He's really good at writing these briefs.
They can do that, by the way. They shouldn't do that. They can do anything they fucking want.
Well, if they don't object to it or bring it up, you can't argue on an appeal.
Right. But they did.
Right.
That's the whole point.
They are. They're doing it.
So it's like, that's the whole thing with the can't and won't and shouldn't. They do anyway. They just do.
Yeah.
So it's in the world now.
So we're dealing with basically statutes 58A and 58B, which I'll get into really briefly. Basically, it authorizes judges to detain or impose strict conditions on defendants who are considered dangerous. Dangerous is important. So the arguments that better are made, and I'm going to try to go through these pretty briefly. The Commonwealth had made one simple request, alcohol testing. Everyone agreed to it, but Kelsey was just asking for an alternative. We know that. And then the Commonwealth submitted a 41-page brief disputing everything under the sun. Everything under the sun is quoted in Bedereau's motion, disputing facts, praising the judge's actions, and presenting facts that went far beyond the scope of the question that was before the single justice. So it's, they're saying this is inconsistent with procedural posture and the appeal and obscures the core issue, which is the lawfulness of revoking her bail. So they're arguing about the lawfulness of what the judge did. The judge, I think, is in trouble. She made a really fucked up decision in this part of this case. So second argument was that the Commonwealth was relying on arguments in the response appeal. This is crazy to me. You ready for this?
Yes.
They are relying on arguments that the grand jury didn't indict on. So the Commonwealth is saying that Kelsey Fitzsimmons pointed a loaded weapon at her colleague, pulled the trigger, and fired again with the intent to kill. The grand jury rejected that theory. They did not bring an indictment on that theory. But the Commonwealth is using it in their argument in this appeal. So the grand jury returned one indictment, which was assault with a dangerous weapon. And the grand jury, they rejected this other theory that the Commonwealth was coming with. And I'm like, how can they come with that theory if they don't have the evidence to back it up? But they don't have the evidence to back it up. She didn't fire her weapon.
What did they show the grand jury then? What did they show? What did
I have no idea.
Yeah. It's interesting. They're almost like they're being like online legal commentators, like, well, like armchair. They're just like saying.
Well, it makes me wonder, did they use ChatGPT to like come up with this grand jury indictment?
Maybe.
Anyway, to me, it's bonkers. And they're trying to show that Kelsey Fitzsimmons is a dangerous person. But Commonwealth doesn't have any standing. The Commonwealth wasn't asking to revoke her bail. The judge made that decision. And I learned a couple of new terms today, which was sua sponte, which means the judge made that decision. Basically, it's without notice. And the judge made it on her own with no motion. The Commonwealth wasn't asking for it.
Right.
She just decided it in the moment. And she did it without notice, which is, we'll get to it in a minute, a problem. Findings under 58A and B, if you don't bring it up in court, you waive that right. You're waiving your right to argue it, which is what I was saying before. They made no motion to ask for bail revocation. Then why are they arguing for it now when they didn't ask for it before? Right. Argument four, this is amazing to me. The Commonwealth is basically saying, hey, listen, we're going to trial in January. So what's the big deal if she just stays in jail for a couple more weeks? But here's the problem. The Commonwealth is not ready to go to trial in January, and neither is the defense, because the Commonwealth hasn't handed over discovery.
Of course, of course.
They haven't even ID'd the alleged weapon she used.
Jesus Christ.
And they haven't turned over any of the materials necessary for any kind of independent review. So there's no way anyone in this case is going to be ready to go to trial in January. So the idea that they're actually making an argument in a brief that says, what's it matter? It's just a couple more weeks. It's not going to be a couple more weeks. It's going to be a bit.
Also, by the way, those couple of weeks include Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they include the holidays. And by the way,
and she wasn't supposed to be in jail.
Being in jail for one day is a big fucking deal. Being in jail for a couple weeks is a big fucking deal. She's been in jail for a long time. There's data that shows that if a defendant is in jail before their prosecution, they have a lower chance of receiving a fair trial or a trial where they can represent themselves fully because they've been in jail and they have not been able to, A, prepare for trial, take care of their mental health, be in a stable, supportive situation,
access to their lawyers, all that stuff. Correct. And, you know, being in jail for one day is a horrendous experience, you know, and especially if you're still recovering from a bullet wound to the chest, which leads me into their fourth argument, which is that Kelsey Fitzsimmons' injuries were really serious and they were documented, and they were directly related to being able to perform the SCRAM device, to perform on the SCRAM device, which is the breathalyzer. She eventually did it. She did it with a lot of pain. She did it with a lot of bad results because she couldn't get the full breath out. But The Commonwealth is saying, this is crazy, this is a bald-faced lie, the Commonwealth is saying that when they presented in that hearing asking for this alternative, that there was no medical evidence that she was in pain. And in the moment, I mean, you can go back and listen to it. In the moment, the defense, Bedereau, is literally saying to the judge, she was shot in the chest, Your Honor. She has broken ribs. Like, her injuries were heavily documented, and the probation officer was on board. He was there in the courtroom, willing to testify, had written an affidavit and signed it saying she can't do this. And we're totally happy if she does a urine sample.
Right.
So that was, they also had a letter from a trauma surgeon saying she was, you know, in a lot of pain. They also had two mental health specialists on record saying that she was not deemed to be dangerous. The judge chose not to hear any of those experts. To me, this is, it's blowing my mind, because what the Commonwealth has put on paper, I mean, almost their entire 41-page brief, they're lies. They're lies that are easily provable because the hearing was on camera. We all watched it. So the next argument is that the Commonwealth says that Kelsey Fitzsimmons didn't propose an alternate method of alcohol testing. You didn't watch the trial.
True.
Do you know that she did? Yeah. Urine. Yeah. That's all. They just want to do a urine sample.
Yeah. No, that is something that was reported in the news.
In the news. And in the hearing, they said she didn't propose an alternate method of, what the actual fuck?
It's like an intern understand. Who just started yesterday wrote it without knowing any of the facts.
Bettereau said it in open court. This is what we're proposing.
Yeah. It's like it's like when Hank Brennan came on at the Karen Reed case and didn't seem to know anything about anything.
Yeah.
And was just saying things that were wildly untrue.
Just out of his ass. Yeah. So that's another argument. The sixth argument is that this is really funny to me. The Commonwealth is saying that Kelsey Fitzsimmons is litigating all these matters in piecemeal, meaning just sporadically, here's a motion, here's another motion, here's another motion. And they're saying, yeah, we have to, because basically the trial court is indicating that urine testing was unknown to it. And they're also, the judge was like, I gave you this order 3 days ago, so why are you coming back to me so late? It was 3 days. You know, so they're just basically they're saying, well, what proof do we have that she had difficulty with the SCRAM device? You know, they provided affidavits from her mom, affidavits.
Who cares?
It doesn't matter.
And I know.
You can file a motion anytime you want. That can't be an argument. This is insane.
It's very upsetting. And it's getting to the point of absurdity where it's like, even if she did everything they said she did, they're still completely fucking her over. They're taking away so many of her rights. And it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
Here's one of the crazy things. This whole entire thing that we're arguing about is about alcohol consumption.
Mm-hmm.
It has been proven through witness testimony and the police officers who were there, that the incident that happened that she is being charged with had nothing to do with alcohol.
Hmm.
So the reason the judge is asking for the alcohol test is based on the fucking, sorry, I'm so angry about this.
Is it conditions of probation kind of situation?
No, it's based on the stupid restraining order that her fiance took out and said that she was drunk when they got into the fight in Maine. But here's the thing. That's also never been litigated. Yeah. No witnesses have taken the stand, sworn in, done testimony, any of that. It's a he said, she said. And the judge is relying on that as if it's fact.
Of course.
Because
that's the Commonwealth's case.
So anyway. Yeah. So under the 58B specifically, the only way that the judge is allowed to revoke bond under these conditions is if they give Kelsey Fitzsimmons notice, they have a hearing about it, and the findings of willful violation or new dangerousness are found. None of these occurred before the judge made her decision in that split second, in that moment, and sent her to jail that same day. Mm. They never gave her notice. They never had a hearing about it. It was just decided in the moment, sua sponte, I guess it's called, and she immediately went to jail, and she's been there ever since. So, again, the Commonwealth wasn't asking for her bail to be revoked. They were very happy to work with them. The judge, for some reason, did this.
Yeah.
So
that's an activist judge. I hate the expression activist judge.
I do too.
It's actually a made-up expression that came up in the 90s that Newt Gingrich and his ilk came up with to about, to be able to frame rulings that they didn't like. So I hate that expression. But an activist judge literally is a judge who does something that no one is asking them to do.
Yeah, and she was pissy about it.
Yeah.
She was pissy about it. She didn't want to hear from the probation officer. She didn't want to look at the affidavits. She didn't want to see the doctor's letter, the surgeon's letter. She was refusing to believe that Kelsey was in pain after being shot in the chest. I mean, the whole thing is about alcohol testing, which has nothing, alcohol has nothing to do with this case.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was the motion that Bedereau filed. I thought it was really concise, really well written. Not that I'm a lawyer or I know, I just play one on TV, but I just was blown away that the Commonwealth in the moment in that hearing was like, oh, what? We don't really care. Okay, whatever. The judge made her decision and now the Commonwealth decides, oh, right, we totally agree with the judge's decision. And here are all the reasons why we agree with it. And most of those reasons are lies. Like, what is happening here? Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Ike said, it's fucked. It's super fucked. I think this is a really interesting case. Because
we're done.
Well, I think this is an interesting case, and as is the Walsh case, but this is an interesting case because I think it's opening a door, and you're seeing anti-Karen Reed people supporting Kelsey Fitzsimmons.
Yes.
So it's sort of widening the tent of of misconduct, and widening the tent of believing misconduct. And I like that. A lot of these anti-Karen Reed people are just sock puppet accounts and they're whatever. Mm-hmm. And some of them are real, whatever. Some of them are, you know, actually McAlberts. But they are like, they're even saying, you know, this isn't the same. This is a woman being wronged. And I like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested to see what happens. I hope that she gets, I don't know where this appeal is going. But I hope she gets out of jail in time for Christmas and can spend some time with her family.
Sure.
And, maybe
and she should
child.
Get a fucking IP deal and be financially comfortable for the rest of her life, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, you know, he's asking her to sell her house so that I don't know if we talked about this, but I found it really interesting. Yeah, we did. We talked about it offline. So the idea that he wants her to sell her house so that he can be taken care of for the next 18 years of child support, assuming that she's going to prison for a really long time. But Ellen, when she was talking to Joey about this case on...
I Think Not.
She made a really good point, and I hadn't thought about it before, but it sounds to me like he actually is wanting her to sell her house and to take the money so that she can't afford a good defense, because she was going to use the sale of her house to pay her lawyers.
Right. Right.
That's so fucked up.
Super fucked
up. Like, what's wrong with these people?
We know what's wrong with them. They're corrupt and evil.
The Commonwealth.
In my opinion.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget, so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Rebecca's got to get on a flight, so I want to try to get through this Brian Walsh stuff really quickly.
Yes, dumpsters.
Peabody.
Google searches.
Peabody.
Google searches we didn't know about before these Google searches.
I mean, there's just so much, but I am starting
to
see
holes. Can
I just
say something about this defense? This defense?
Yes, please.
So the defense is now she died of like sudden adult death syndrome, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I came upon her dead body and I was so sure that nobody would believe me that she just spontaneously died.
Combusted.
Despite the fact that there probably would have been like an autopsy and so forth, that I felt like I had no choice in the moment because I was distraught, but to gruesomely take apart her body and buy materials to do said body take apart. So I had enough time to think about going to fucking Home Depot and all that shit. I had he planned and executed and searched online for stuff to gruesomely take apart her body. But it was all because she died of this.
And porn.
Yeah. So I am just like that. Okay. Unless it's true, which in my opinion, it probably isn't. Unless it is actually true, which I don't think anybody thinks it is. Right. Why go with that and not go with something that is more palatable as a story to buy as a juror, such as she died in a way that looked like I could have killed her. So like actually looked like it. Like we were having an argument. She fell. She hit her head on the or she fell down the stairs or she, you know, drowned in the bathtub after taking too many pills or some shit because there's no body. So you can't. Right. So it's like, why not say she died in a way that I thought would look like I had killed her? And given all this stuff like that, even to me, probably wouldn't be jurors wouldn't buy it. But like this one, it's like insulting to every family member of anybody ever whose family has died in this, whose family member has died in this way. Like, it's like, it's not only that, but it's so, it's like funny. Like, if you were to tell me a guy did these Google searches, did whatever, carved up his wife, admits to all that stuff, yet the way she actually died was she just died spontaneously of this sudden death syndrome thing, I'd be like, that's fucking funny. It's fun. It's like comical.
I couldn't believe that Tipton said it with a straight face, and he said it with a lot of emotion.
Yes,
I was real shocked.
An opening argument was wild.
Yeah, so opening arguments were okay. First of all, a couple of observations. This guy Greg Connor, who's the ADA, who's the lead on this case, I think he's one of those. He's the guy who adamantly refused to retry Karen Reed again. So right off the bat, I think this guy has, you know, some more scruples. Some
he
more
seems
morals.
Normal. He seems, and this he's judge normal. Seems normal too. Fournier.
This judge. Let me just say, you were absolutely right. Her name is pronounced Frenia, and I have the biggest crush on her. And I
super
cannot.
Normal.
She's super hot. She's so beautiful, and she knows this case inside and out.
Yeah,
and she has complete control over this courtroom, and she is not placating, and she is not condescending to anybody, and she has the utmost respect for every single person who is sitting in this courtroom, including Brian Walsh, which is amazing.
It's what you're supposed to be if you're a judge. Yeah. You're supposed to be granting somebody their rights. And like
she literally, like they'll be like, okay, can we pull up record 272, blah, blah, blah. And everyone starts looking for it and they're like, oh, that's not the right one. What number is it? And she's like, you mean 274. Right. Like she knows the record. She knows everything. And I'm talking, there's a binder on this case that's like this big, and it's got over 3,000 pages in it of searches.
I like that she's not doing the thing where she's relying on her later jury instructions to explain things.
No.
In the moment, she'll turn to the jury and she'll say something like,
yes.
So this evidence that you're about to see, just to be clear, both sides have agreed that you can see
the stipulation. Right.
And so it's like, but she's describing it in the moment so that they don't think that the defense is being surprised or whatever. Like she's describing the legal process in the moment to the jury. And that is so helpful when giving your instructions to the jury, because there's so much bias in a juror's mind that goes into deliberation because of everything they've seen and heard. That having those measured explanations along the way, I think are going to be very helpful.
And she does this thing. She does this thing. She asks for grounds on objections. And so the grounds are said out loud in the court and we all get
which
to hear it.
Loud. Yep.
Which is lovely. So anyway, the Commonwealth has to prove five elements beyond a reasonable doubt in order to get murder one. And I'm going to say this right now, though we are laughing about the defense and what they're saying actually happened, I think the prosecution, if the jury can get past some of the searches, I think the prosecution is going to have a difficult time proving premeditation. And the defense is doing an excellent job so far picking that part of it, that element apart. And they've done it already. They started it on day two with Guarino. But basically, day one, opening statements, the Commonwealth, you know, was... it was a little bit awkward right off the bat, and I think that's just because the case was just starting. He told a story, and he went through the story from the perspective of the HR director for Tishman Speyer, because he was establishing right off the bat that her company was more concerned about the fact that she was missing than Brian was. They're the ones who called Cohasset first, but Brian actually called the HR rep and said, you know, I haven't seen Anna and all that stuff. So... but the first time she's actually reported missing is by the head of security for Tishman Speyer, and that was on January 4th. They are going to go, they go through evidence, which is photo, you know, like photos of the family home, videos, her banking records, objects are the Tyvek suit and hatchet, hacksaw, all that stuff. So basically, I don't want to get too far into the weeds. I want to kind of cover what we covered for the first 3 days. The first 2 days of the trial, after opening statements, Harrison Schmidt took the stand. He was the lead investigator for the local Cohasset police before MSP became involved. And he sort of started his rundown of, you know, the first time that he went to the house to interview Brian. They did three interviews with Brian. All were recorded. I want to say this right off the top. About 10 minutes into the testimony from Harrison Schmidt, I was like, oh, they actually did an investigation. Like, they did more to try to find Anna Walsh in 2 days than the entirety of MSP and Canton did to try to find who killed John O'Keefe. They toured the house. They went into Brian Walsh's house. They got permission to walk around the house with him and investigate. They got banking records, phone records. They seized, with his permission in the beginning, this will become later, it'll become important, but in the beginning, they got his laptop, all the cell phones in the house, everything they needed.
Investigative stuff. Did they secure the crime scene?
They did not secure the crime scene. And there are some issues. Like, the defense is able to pull apart some of the stuff that they did wrong. And the defense is really focusing on what they could have done more of, which is, I find, really interesting. Because, and this comes up right away, when Harrison went into the basement with Brian.
Who's Harrison?
Which I think is what Harrison Schmidt, Harrison Schmidt, the lead investigator from local Cohasset police. When he went into the basement with Brian, and I think that most people think the basement is where he dismembered her.
Makes sense.
Because he did Google searches about getting blood out of concrete. Harrison Schmidt saw a garbage bag that he could see through, and he could see pieces of rug in it. And he towed it. He like manipulated it with his toe, but didn't open it, didn't ask to look inside of it, didn't do anything like that. They also went into the master bedroom, and in the master bedroom, there is a foot wide hole in the ceiling. And for some reason, the piece of missing ceiling is just stuffed into a bedside drawer, which is really weird. So he asked him about that, and Brian, since he had gone into the attic to put Christmas decorations away and had almost fallen through the attic.
His foot went, that's reasonable. Initially I was thinking maybe cast off.
It's reasonable. Yeah, it's reasonable if you got to look at, I'm going to send you a picture of the hole. It's not reasonable.
Okay. But I will say, could that have been to like get rid of cast off on the ceiling? But then why would he have kept the ceiling piece?
I mean, it could have been that they actually were having a physical fight and something happened. Something got thrown, you know.
I don't think it was that. Here's why. I don't care what the ceiling piece looks like, because I could bring out a whole ceiling by stepping on it. I think that he was thinking that he could call someone in to repair it, just stick it, puzzle piece it, and just like, that's why I think he kept it. I mean.
But it's weird that it's just stuffed in the drawer and he didn't try to hide it before the cops got there.
That's what makes me think there's probably a non-murdery explanation for the ceiling piece.
So this is really interesting to me. And this is something that the jury understands, I think, even though they haven't fully brought it in yet. There are three audio recorded interviews with Brian. The first two are just Brian and the cops, and they're in his house.
I heard
that. The third, the third is with his white collar attorney for the art heist case. And it has MSP involved as well. The interesting thing about these interviews is that.
Wait, they were all recorded?
They were audio. Yeah, we're listening to it in court.
Amazing.
They're not great.
Imagine interviewing somebody even in their house and recording it.
I know. It's
unbelievable,
crazy. He's not
right?
even a suspect yet. He's just
a guy. He was a fucking suspect.
So here's the interesting thing. Anna was already dead when all three of these interviews happened, and he lied about every single thing he said just about in those interviews to the police.
Yeah.
So when he's talking about her travel, when a lie as small as she took an Uber or a taxi, he said taxi, which I thought was strange because not many people use that word anymore. She took an Uber or a taxi. They couldn't find any records of Uber, right? So I think that was probably their initial like bing. But here's the crazy thing. And here's my observation about Brian Walsh. I'm pretty convinced, in my opinion, he is a complete and utter sociopath or psychopath, not really sure. Whichever one it is that you don't have any emotions.
Yeah. I think that's sociopath.
I don't know which one it is.
I think that's sociopathy. Yeah.
So here's
if
what,
I'm
here's
wrong,
what
it's okay.
I,
you can at me. I don't care. I'm not a psychologist.
So here's what I observed in these audio recordings, which are the biggest part of the past 3 days of testimony. His voice never changes. He is completely monotone. He over-explains everything. He refers to Anna in the past tense throughout the entire 3 days of interviews. He also does this weird thing where he says, like, if they ask him a hard question about their relationship, he'll over-explain and he'll say, my wife and I are a team. My wife and I love each other. My wife, he said my wife probably 50 times.
He doesn't say Anna, yeah, yeah.
He doesn't say Anna. He says, past tense, my wife. Here's the crazy thing. In the background of these audio recordings, which is, it's so distracting and it's awful to listen to,
yeah.
There are two different things that happen. He has 3 young boys under the age of 6 and they are screaming and crazy. In the first interview, it's hard to even hear what they're saying because the boys are in and out of the kitchen. And I'm like, okay, guys, cops, can we separate the kids so that they don't have to hear what their father's talking about, A, and B, can't hear a goddamn thing. And the one of my favorite parts in the audio is Brian is talking. The kids are screaming. He is saying nothing to them. He's not saying, okay, guys, just calm down. Let's go play with your toys. Let's do something, blah, blah, blah. He's not engaging.
Daddy's talking to the murder police.
Yeah. He's not engaging with them at all. And in the background, one of the kids is yelling. The oldest kid is yelling. And you hear Brian go, oh, I thought he was saying truck. He's not saying truck. And then you hear the kid go, fuck, in the background. In the background. And then at one point, the middle kid comes in. This is so ominous. The middle kid comes in and sets down on the table Anna's glasses and then walks out. Right? And I was just like, what the fuck? So all this is happening. And in all of that chaos, you can hear Harrison Schmidt getting a little bit like, oh, okay, the kids are, and Brian is nothing, none of that. Calm, cool, collected, no emotion, no like, oh my God, I don't know where my wife is. Can you, you know, why are we sitting here doing this? Can you go look for my wife? Blah, blah, blah. Just every single detail you might need to know about my federal case, about her traveling so much, about she missed Thanksgiving. She missed Thanksgiving because she was on a date with her boyfriend in Belfast. And then I think it's the third interview or second or third interview. His mom is in the other room with the kids. Yuri Buchanek's in the other room interviewing her.
Yuri!
So she can hear everything Brian's saying. Brian can hear everything she's saying. We can kind of hear bits and pieces in the background. And then the third interview here. Oh, I want to introduce another German Shepherd into the mix. They have a German Shepherd puppy.
Hmm.
In the third interview, the German Shepherd puppy is scream yelping throughout the entire interview. And me, you know me,
it's
as
chaotic.
A dog person,
yeah.
It's so, so chaotic. And Brian, okay, just for the audiences, I said this in the live. I owned a dog walking company for 13 years. I have never in my life been in a room with an owner of a dog who is freaking the fuck out. I've never seen someone not even flinch that the dog is freaking out. Usually, like, owners get embarrassed.
100%. Yeah, I get embarrassed. Briscoe is a barker. It's very embarrassing.
Yeah, owners get embarrassed and they're like, okay, buddy, all right, calm down, calm down. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about my dog. I'm so sorry about none of that. He keeps telling his story in monotone and they are asking hard questions. They're starting to ask, did you do anything to Anna? And the dog is like, rah, rah.
So this is beyond, because I hate affect evidence. I don't think someone's demeanor points to anything.
I agree, but
this sounds like this goes beyond that.
Way, way, way beyond. I said this in the live last
night. I said
the
dog thing is more convincing to me than anything else that you've said.
Abso-friggin-lutely. That and the kids. I have to say.
I'm sorry. People learn to tune out their kids. They 100% do. I understand they're screaming.
But in a situation like that, it's like an embarrassing
it's odd,
kind of
but
thing.
It's not impossible that they would not be. They would
but the
kids.
Dog.
You do not ever learn to tune out your barking dog. I'm sorry.
No, you do not.
My terrier, Stuart, who's 15 years old, 14 and a half years old, he's a fucking barker, UPS truck, whatever. And then it will go on for like an hour and a half and we're trying to watch TV or whatever. I hear every single bark and every single bark makes me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And nothing. He is like,
wild.
He doesn't hear it. He's like
so
monotone.
Convincing. You convinced
it's
me with just
so
that.
Fucking weird. But anyway, okay. So that we listened to all that stuff. They brought on a ton of witnesses on day three. And basically, these are all people that are just supporting the idea that Anna didn't get on planes when she was supposed to. She didn't get an Uber. This is her life. She has over $1 million in a life insurance policy, and he's the beneficiary. And then we also got into a multitude of these internet searches. And the person who took us through those internet searches was Nicholas Guarino.
Nikki G.
Was an awful witness who Surprise. Said, I don't know, I don't remember, or I don't recall.
I saw the one times. Thing he did say that everybody that? Was talking about when the he porn? Talked about what the search term in a particular page meant, like how he could peg it to time.
The 227 search.
And it's funny because so that goes back to the Commonwealth saying and hiring two experts to say
yes.
that the 227 search happened and that was the last time she opened the tab, mm-hmm. not the time she actually, that's when she started the tab, not the time yep. she made the search. And he said something completely contradictory to that. And I'm just thinking, this is why they had to hire two extra people yeah. to say this random thing that no other expert in the world believes.
Yes.
And it's, yeah, it was funny. It was honestly struck me as a great opportunity for the defense.
Yeah. And he also said something along the lines of, oh, well, when I was doing those searches, I was using the old Cellebrite. Now there's a new improved version of Cellebrite.
Great.
And I was like, oh, fuck off.
Oh, the one that erases the 227 search?
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Yeah, that one. But he was a bad witness. The defense was able to establish that. So they have this binder that's got over 3,000 pages in it of the searches. And it's going to go to the jury. It's going to go into deliberations with them. The judge actually peeked this and she asked for a sidebar. Because she, I think, is starting to understand, oh, that can't happen. Basically, in that binder, the defense was able to get Guarino to say that half of the records in the binder were duplicates.
Hmm.
But there's no way to differentiate between the duplicates because he never did a key or any kind of coding or any kind of index or anything.
Of course.
So the judge was like, sidebar. And I think she's probably like, you guys aren't going to be able to give this to the jury the way that it is. This is ridiculous. They're not going to be able to page through this and figure out what's happening.
What Canone would say is they'll be able to figure it out.
They know how police procedure works.
Everybody knows that if you see something and it's the same, that it's a duplicate. Come on, Mr. Jackson.
There's no sighing either. You don't hear the judge on her mic.
I know.
Mic.
She's great.
You don't hear it.
I love that you have a crush on her. That's,
I have a huge crush on her. I think she's so hot. I even told Lindsay last night. She was like, is there anyone else that you think is hot outside of me? And I was like, yeah, the judge in the Brian Walsh case. Okay, so let's just get into a few of the searches. I'm going to throw a few of them out there. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how the defense pulled some of this apart, actually. So I'm going to just say them. I'm not going to put quotes around them. This is what they said. Best way to dispose of a body. Similar websites. How long for someone missing to inherit? How long missing to be dead? Can you throw away body parts? Is it possible to clean DNA off of a knife? I'm the user of my wife's credit card. She is missing. Best way to dispose of body parts after a murder. That's a big one. Because that one happened on December 29th, which would lead to premeditation. Numerous website searches on January 1st about cleaning blood with ammonia, bleach, hydrogen peroxide. Websites, is it better to throw away crime scene clothes or wash them? One website, you want to get away with murder? Use a special detergent. internet searches, how long does Lowe's keep their security footage? How to saw a body? How to dismember a body?
Lowe's keep their security footage is honestly my favorite one so far.
Yeah. How can you be charged with murder without a body? Can you identify a body with broken teeth? That's new. And then he also searched up these apartment complexes in Brockton and Chelsea. One of them's called Chapman West. And that's where one of the dumpsters was. And they have surveillance of him going to that dumpster. So basically, they started asking him about his movements on that day, the day after. So I think it was January 1st, 2nd, 3rd. And he was like, oh, I had to make a trip to Stop and Shop. I had to get some milk. The milk was very important to my kids. So I had to, he keeps focusing on the milk. And then he went to his mom's house and he was very upset about because his mom had just had cataract surgery.
Did he stop at Lanx along the way to his mom's house?
No, he didn't. He didn't stop at Lanx. But all of the MSP troopers that are involved are Tully, Guarino, DeChico.
Isn't Fanning in there?
Proctor, Fanning.
Yeah.
There are more, and I'll come up with them. But anyway, a lot of them were on that third call. You hear Michael Proctor introduce himself, and then he asks one question on the call. But anyway, so while going back just a minute, while Harrison Schmidt was doing his, you know, walk through the house with Brian, he found the trash bag in the basement, did nothing with it. And then they also investigated the car, which is a Volvo. And I'm not sure if this is a cute couple-y coin phrase that they've decided to use or if it's just the Boston accent, but they call it a Vovo. He kept saying, well, we went through the Vovo. And it was like, there's no L in this word. It's just a Vovo.
I think that's an accent thing, but yes.
I don't know. It sounded like a cute thing that they were like, it was almost like, oh, we call it a Vovo. Like, I don't know. Because he was also looking at buying her a Porsche.
Yeah,
and like,
how?
That's crazy shit.
The fuck?
They actually have a ton of money.
Oh, okay.
She's making over $300,000 a year. They've got over $200,000 in investment accounts. They have probably 10 properties, investment properties, and they had just sold one. So this is, let's get into the defense actually. I want to say one other thing. So when they went to look at the Vovo, Harrison Schmidt saw a folded up tarp in the back of the car and he never investigated it. They did later they found blood all over the car. Brian's blood, her blood, blood all over the car. So basically they asked Brian, what was she wearing when she left the house? He said she was wearing gray, green hunter boots and an Hermes watch and a black jacket. So when they got all this surveillance footage back from all these places that he had gone to, CVS, Lowe's, Stop and Shop, Home Depot, Home Goods, and he bought like ammonia at one place, and then he bought 2 pounds of baking soda at another place, and he bought rugs and air freshener, and he bought a hatchet and a hacksaw and snips and a Tyvek suit. He spent $400 at Lowe's. They found the receipt for that in the car that day. They started looking into all this stuff. They got surveillance from every single place he went, including the dumpsters he went to. And they picked up the dumpsters and they took them to Peabody. And in Peabody, they pulled everything out of the dumpsters. They found her black jacket, her Hunter rain boots, her Hermes watch, her Prada bag, which he knew all of this. I found this really weird. And maybe this is just me having a stereotype about
husbands. These people are brand conscious.
No, but he would know when Hermes watches.
Yeah, no, they're brand conscious. I promise you, these are status focused people. He would know to buy her.
She took her Prada bag.
Yeah, he would know that because that's probably how they talked. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they found her Prada bag, her Hermes watch, her Hunter boots, and her black jacket, and her COVID vax card in this one dumpster.
Wow. It's interesting that he didn't keep the Hermes watch given his sloppiness and like try to pawn it because that seems like something he would do.
I mean, they found the Tyvek suit also in this dumpster and it had both his and her blood on it. Her blood was all over everything. There was reddish brown stains all over everything. The defense tried to say basically that a raccoon broke into the dumpster and killed something and that's why there's blood everywhere. But that's not true. Here's a really interesting point, and this is something I didn't know before and it was brought up in one of the audio interviews. Apparently, he had a startup, a cybersecurity startup company that he owned. Cybersecurity. This guy planned to take apart his wife's body by watching YouTube videos.
Yes. And like, by the way, Hermes watches are like between $30,000 and $100,000. So I'm surprised he didn't keep that shit. Yeah, that's amazing to me that because he would know, I mean, ostensibly know that the searches would be discoverable, right?
Yep. Wow. Yep. Yep. But that's some of the stuff that he was searching, though. He was like, you know, what do the police need in order to, like, do they need a search warrant for my phone? But he readily gave them his phone. So here are a couple of issues.
Oh, here's one that's only $1,200, just so I'm going to add to that. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Here, I'm going to try to wrap this up really quick because there are a couple of other things.
It's my fault because I have to get on a plane, but we can do another one when I get back if you want.
Well, we're going to have to because William Fastow is testifying today and that's her boyfriend.
Or I can do it with you from my phone when I'm away and you can have janky audio and video of me, but that's fine.
We'll figure it out. Figure it out. I mean, there's only a few other things that happened. Day three was just like all information that didn't really go anywhere. But the defense poked a couple of holes because what they started to do, and they did it with Guarino. He tore Guarino apart. This is what he's accusing the prosecution of doing. He's accusing the prosecution of cherry picking out of 3,000 pages, the porn video about cheating wife gets impregnated porn, right? And so Tipton, says, this is one of the moments I loved about the Guarino testimony. Tipton says to Guarino, did you watch the video? And he's like, no, I don't watch those kind of videos. And then Tipton is like, well, do you know that when you go to Pornhub, that it gives you suggested videos? And he's like, yeah, I'm not the kind of person who goes on a website like that. And I was just like, whatever, Guarino. Yes, you do. So basically what he's saying is, well, you don't know if he was just looking at regular old porn and these things popped up and he chose them. And you also are saying that he basically he's poking holes in the premeditation part of it, because the only time that the word murder came up before January 1st in his searches was because it was a suggested search that he clicked on. Right. After he never searched murder. And he's right about that. He also never searched up and tried to discover if she was having an affair, which we think he did because her iMessages or her Messenger from Facebook were going through to his phone, which, again, cybersecurity. I don't understand.
Amazing.
He readily, like, the cops watched him put the passcode into the iPad, and that's how they got it. And he literally, in the third interview, blames his 6-year-old son for making all of these searches. Because his six-year-old son, who can't spell any of these words, dismemberment, can't spell that, was sitting in his room with the iPad at the time that these searches happened. But the iPad was synced to his laptop with his Apple ID. But in the interview, he's like, I don't know how that happened. Oh, my son. Oh, my God. Blah. So anyway.
Maybe he was following what was going on online in the Karen Reid universe and people stealing each other's Apple IDs and then sharing material that they find on synced devices.
Yeah. So anyway, that's pretty much it. But I would say that the defense is really starting to poke holes because they're saying the prosecution is cherry picking these search results. As long as it says cheating wife, they're putting it in there. But they're not paying attention to the other 37,000 that don't say cheating wife and say, you know, I want to say one more thing. One of the main arguments for him searching up divorce, which was a big thing in the opening, and it was a big thing with Guarino, because he owed almost like $450,000 in restitution for this art heist. And they were going to have to figure out a way to pay it. And they'd already paid, I think, like $175,000. But they were starting to sell their investment properties, and Anna was starting to get concerned that they were going to lose that money to the restitution. And so they were actually talking about divorce. And she talked about that to her boyfriend. Mm. Like, the only reason that we're talking about divorce is because we have to split our assets so that we don't lose them. So they poked some holes. And I think a smart jury is sitting there going, I don't know, maybe she did die in her sleep. They're going to have a bunch of experts come on and say she died in her sleep. So if that shred of doubt gets into the jury's minds, even one person, it's not premeditated, which I don't think it was premeditated. I think it happened in the moment.
Would you like to place a bet on this, even though that's a gruesome and disgusting thing to do?
I don't know. I don't think I'm ready to yet. I'm pretty sure. I mean, damning.
Very sure. I will never say 100% on something like
this. But murder one?
Yeah. I think he'll get murder one.
They have to say it's premeditated.
Because you know me. I'm willing to give anyone the benefit of the doubt in the criminal justice system because it's so fucking skewed.
But what happens when we get to the Michael Proctor shit?
I don't care. He's
on the defense's witness list.
If Karen Reid had Googled a bunch of shit about how to convince people you didn't hit your boyfriend with your car.
like Jen McCabe was Googling how long does it take to die in the cold.
Exactly. How do I convince people that I didn't hit my boyfriend with my car?
That's the argument, though. Like, that's the argument we're having right now.
I wipe my infotainment system to take out my GPS data? Like, that would be fucking
damning.
There
may have been people who didn't believe that Jen McCabe made that 227 search. So what if there are people
that
believe...
Sure, but that's also not as damning as how do I cut up my wife's body after I murder her? True. That's fucking damning.
There was one search that was... he asked what to do with a murder or a knife that has HIV blood on it.
I saw. Yeah, it was very strange.
I don't know what that means.
That may have been a search that happened. I mean, I can imagine that.
Yeah,
happening.
Like a suggested search?
Yes, I can.
Because the life
that.
Insurance company said she was a number one for health. And so they gave her like really low premiums because she was so healthy.
Maybe he has HIV.
She was, That's, I don't know. He had cuts on his fingers. Mm-hmm. They showed pictures of
and
those.
And his blood
but
was
anyway.
Found, so yeah.
Yeah. So
wowie
that's
wow. Thank you, Mel, for the download. I can't wait to talk to you more about this. I'm sorry I have to run to a plane.
That's
question
okay.
for you. I'm going yeah. to where you live in yes. the world. Do I bring my like Canada Goose heavy parka or just like a jacket?
You bring your Canada Goose heavy
I was
parka,
leaning toward
parka.
That. That's a pain in the ass to bring on
it
the plane.
Is
okay, great.
Cold.
Yeah.
It's cold.
It's
today.
I mean, it's 20 degrees here this morning, and I saw the weather is like 30 there. And when you're in a city, 30 is way colder than it is when you're
yeah,
in
and
the
it's windy in D.C. because of all right. the little building tunnels.
Thank
so.
You. Thank you for the advice.
Right.
Go to Mel
Thanks,
anytime
everybody.
You want advice about your proper outerwear in the greater capital region.
Bring the Canada Goose.
Thanks
right,
so much,
take
everybody.
Care. Have a
thank
safe
you
flight.
For your tips. Give us a
Thanks
Venmo.
Thanks for the tips. I will give you a Venmo.
Bye.
Thanks, Rebecca.